Aristippus claimed himself a follower of Socrates, but he was disdained by his fellow disciples Plato and Xenophon, both of whom mocked him in their writings. No writings of Aristippus by his own hand have survived, although we have these details and anecdotes from Diogenes Laertius. Aristippus was by birth a citizen of Cyrene, and as Aeschines informs us, was drawn to Athens by the fame of Socrates. Having come forward as a lecturer or a sophist, as Phanius of Eresius, the Peripatetic, informs us, he was the first of the followers of Socrates to charge fees and send money to his master. He was capable of adapting himself to place, time, and person, of playing his part appropriately under whatever circumstances. He derived pleasure from what was present and did not toil to procure the enjoyment of something not present. Hence Diogenes the Cynic, who lived on the streets of Athens, naked, a beggar, sleeping, it is said, in an old tub, called him the king's poodle. One day Diogenes was washing the dirt from vegetables that he had been given to eat, saw Aristippus passing, and jeered at him in these terms: "If you had learnt to make these your diet, you would not have to pay court to kings." To which Aristippus rejoined him, "And if you knew how to get along with kings, you would not have to be washing vegetables." Being asked what he had gained from philosophy, he replied, "The ability to feel at ease in any society." Being reproached for his extravagance, he said, "If I were wrong to be extravagant, it would not be right to have holidays for gods or weddings." When the king inquired what was the reason that philosophers go to rich men's houses, while rich men no longer visit philosophers, his reply was, "The one know what they need, while the other do not." Hear then the story of Aristippus from the city of Wenatchee in the year 1951.
Rackety song, get off that track, it isn't where you belong. Well, clickety-clack, along, that train is coming at chunga-chung. Clickety-clack, a mile away, well, he hasn't a second of time to stay. He sings a noisy rackety song, a rickety-rockety-rackety song. Get off that track, it isn't where you belong. He goes over the bridge and across the lake, a mile a minute he has to make. The cinders fall in a fiery range, and the tunnel is waiting to swallow the train.
"Coffee's in the street," Sam, the pantry man, sung out to my chef, letting the spigot snap back, his oily black face nearly as sweaty as my own, but somehow the sweat on him just seemed to luster his complexion, made his smiling servitude to the posh customer all the more pleasing to them, you might think. Sam needn't have told me. I knew it. I saw it. I saw it 15 minutes ago, but there are dishes on dishes piling up that gotta be fucking washed, which he can see too, the asshole. The coffee had dropped below the bottom of the glass tube gauge mounted against the chrome skin of the enormous electric urn, and I got to stand on the lid of the trash can to get the top off. "Third seating," he reminded us over his shoulder as he turned, giving me a snotty look, I was thinking, and sauntered back to stand with his back to me, his hands folded behind him, looking like a goddamn overseer of his own self. Rocking on his heels amongst the close-up camp of the other Negro waiters, counting up their fucking tips. They got wads of dough, bills on bills, flipping the bundled edges with licked fingertips, adding it all up. "We won't get any of it, I'll bet." Bulging trouser pockets of coins. "We'll get some handfuls of them coins. It's what it is. The cook's is white, the waiters is niggers. And I suppose they treat us no better than they're treated by us. It is what it is. no matter who I is. There comes an edge to a man's skin you cannot get past. No, not almost. I pulled out the coffee basket, jumped down, flipped up the trash can lid and knocked its loggy grounds into the trash can and tossed the canister back in to fill it up with fresh grounds and start the hot water dribbling through it with the red button there on the side. The water, hot to a hiss-spitting boil by and for the same steam turbines that drives the train, courses out of the engine itself from car to car by way of many valves and long pipes and steamy joints, running all the way through and up to 20 lengths of as many cars or more. Our dining car, slap in the middle, serving eight goddamn Pullman cars behind us and 10 fucking coach cars in front, plus the mail car and our dormitory against the three diesel engines hauling our ass. Making a header straight uphill into the sunset on the crest. A big run. Summer travelers. Still less than we had yesterday before we unloaded at Glacier Park for the tourists. Still, four services for dinner is a lot. I will be up till well past midnight cleaning this shitty kitchen. Hayire was singing like he always does. He has a million songs, I swear. I pray, dear Lord, for Jesus' sake, give us this day a T-bone steak. Hallowed be thy holy name, but don't forget to send the same. Observe me on my bended legs, I'm asking you for ham and eggs. And if thou havest custard pies, I like, dear Lord, the largest size. And that's when, while he's still singing in the middle of that song, he jumped the train. I mean, he jumped straight out of the wide open swinging doors like a man aflame with gasoline fire, while we was climbing a slow, snaky track in labor of our long load, dragging it hard up them Cascade Mountains just above Wenatchee. Among them ripe apple trees in them hidden hills out there. After he had seen that pretty naked lady there, I seen her too, from the cook station in the dining car. A naked woman standing outside in her old-fashioned Victorian bathtub in that golden light. Leaned over, dripping wet from his grinning chin into the dishwasher, looking out that band of windows, that low rectangle above the counter, just enough to let the light in to shine so to see while you dice your onions. But too low unless you lean down low and onto your elbows to peer out of it for you to see anything outside except the ties marking time on the roadbed and the sunburnt weeds beside it. But resting between servings, looking out that window at about sunset, there in the gilded gloaming, he seen her. Sweet nymph of his good luck. Naked as nature, and he wants her. Standing to her knees in the milky bath water of her swan-like porcelain tub, put out in the meadow of her own backyard for show. In the midst of fruiting orchard, and she, smiling up at us, soapy water dripping off that soapy washcloth that she held poised in her hand, water drizzling silvery from off her wet, pointy-tipped tits, a flower of fluffy suds on her belly. She, smiling up at him as queenly as a cat. He heard the call, and I cannot blame him. He jumps the train with an oath and a prayer, still wearing his cook's apron, but I seen him fling it off just as he ran back to embrace her, and so, of course, I have to do his job now, too. But that's a promotion in pay and position, so I do not complain. This is not the odd thing about this story. But how it goes when we got to Seattle, and done our layover. I got back on the train for the trip back to St. Paul and was going to take up my new cook spot, and there he was, haywire his own self, a lit Lucky Strike cigarette dangling at his mouth, leaning on the stainless steel counter, his dressy silver-belly cowboy hat tipped back on his head, while Chef and Sam, the pantry man, was loading up and putting away the stores, and he, grinning and gesticulating and gabbing about his fabulous fornication in the orchard, while his cigarette bobbled loosely on his lips, telling his wild lies, his rosewood guitar slung across his back, dressed in his best dress boots, full quill ostrich toe, with an ornamentally stitched shank, and his old, worn but clean blue jeans, an illustrious cream rayon cowboy shirt with mother-of-pearl snaps and smiley stitched breast pockets, joked, fooling, and politicking like nothing had happened. And nobody, not even the commissary boss, said a fucking thing about him jumping and quitting the job in the middle of dinner. How he got away with everything, I do not know. But sometimes I think it was just that everybody wished they could be just like him. And so cut him slack out of some idea that, well, hell, somebody's got to live like he do. Shit, fuck, and goddamn it, if it ain't true. He swept his guitar around from behind his back, and while everybody else worked, he played on it and sang to them. One evening, as the sun went down and the jungle fires were burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for land that's far away besides the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the big rock candy mountains." "What we want," he said to me once, "comes from out of the memories of childhood. What attracts us without any deliberate choice of our own is what we dream when we've got no mind at all. And then, when once we have obtained it, we never not need to seek nothing else. In the Big Rock Candy Mountain, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day, and the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees and the lemonade springs and the bluebird sings in the Big Rock Candy Mountains." In the morning at 4 a.m., I climbed out of my top bunk, splashed some of the stale water out of the metal sink up into my face, flushed the train toilet, a misty rush of spray of urine back blowing up out of the cupped hole that popped open, exposed the spotlit, the rushing rail bed tearing away under the train. A hollow roar awoke me. Awoke some others, maybe, and I made my way down 6 coach cars to the dining car, through the sleeping crowd of men and women and children smelling of B.O. and greasy garlic and halitosis, and tried not to fall on them as I lurched with the train doing its cannonball on the plateau heading to Idaho. It felt frosty in the kitchen for an early September day. Smelled like bleach. I made coffee first, and I was in there a full 10 minutes pulling out what I needed for making muffins and dumping a bag of dusty spuds into the sink so I could wash and grate some for hash browns Cookie would make, when I noticed Haywire had been crouching at the top of the chef's cabinet all along. There between the ceiling and the top of the cabinet crouched, stuffed in like a snake to strike, but looking more like a bird of prey on account of his gangly elbows akimbo and his hands tucked up into his armpits and his eyes bugging out at me. And I thought, goddamn, if he didn't just look like one of them cartoon vultures with a big old Adam's apple bobbing on his neck and his big nose for a pointy beak. Christ, he scared me. I said to him, what the fuck? He must have been waiting for me in the dark. Jesus, he sure is crazy. He jumped out of the perch onto his feet, laughing, limber as a child. Though I got to tell you, if I knew his age, I knew it was somewhere on the north side of 60, maybe 70. Though he did not look like maybe a well-worn 30, maybe 40. He chain-smoked cigarettes, lit one right then. Never mind the ash falling on the food. Lucky strikes, and had fine lines on his face, like the crackling on porcelain glaze. But his eyes were blue as sun-lit cornflowers. His eyes shined bright blue as though they got gleams inside of them. He started the stove, and lit the burners, and swung about and rang a slam the huge cast-iron frying pan on top of the hissing ring of blue gas flames, and slapped down a couple of full slabs of raw bacon rashers onto it, and soon we was warm and smelled like smoked meat and grease. I made up the muffin batter, and he winked at me and said, looky here, kid, and got some oranges from out of the refrigerated closet and grated orange peel into my batter and squeezed the nude oranges in his big fist till they popped and drained juice onto the batter and then nodded at it and told me to go ahead. Then as I stirred up the pulp and juice and rind into the batter and started to spoon it into my muffin tins, picking out pips I'd missed, he got up on the trash can and popped open the coffee maker lid and tossed something into the basket of grounds that was still soaking up boiling hot water. What was that? I asked. Nothing, said he, but tossed some sort of dark wrapper onto the trash after he got off the can. Okay, I said. And he sat up on the counter and sang a song to me while I fished out fried bacon for the steam table. About some pretty blue eyes and some dying girl and her lost lover, and I couldn't help thinking of home. And I think I would have started to cry myself. And he seen me tightening up and stopped mid-song, said he was sorry, and he hopped down beside me and said, here, kid, and finished up shredding the hash browns for me and started singing a different song, a cappella. Clickety-clack, along, along, the train is coming, a-chung, a-chung. Clickety-clack, a mile away, it hasn't a second of time to stay. It sings a noisy, rackety song, a rickety-rockety, rackety song. Get off the track, it isn't where you belong. Over the bridge, across the lake, a mile a minute it has to make. The cinders fall in fiery range. A tunnel is waiting to swallow the train. It sings a noisy, rackety song, a rickety, rackety, rockety song. Goodbye, goodbye. Tomorrow will come again. We had 5 services of breakfast on account of so many in the coaches. Probably the only meal these regular folk would eat on the entire trip. The cheapest we sell, and the best deal, too. What with coffee and a muffin and a fruit coming with all breakfasts, and you always get 3 eggs and 4 of the meats. Juice is much too pricey nowadays, and there still ain't that much to be seen, even since the war's been done now these 4 years past. I remember that was the first thing I'd done when I got home from the Pacific. Got to my own Frigidaire and put a full-up pitcher of fresh orange juice in it and drank 3 glasses full. And I think you thought me pretty funny. And you laughed. I laughed too. And I just sat there at the kitchen table for maybe 5 hours just looking at everything I had and at you beside me and my daughter on my lap, and I think I thought I was never going to die. I was so glad to be alive. It made everything all right that we had done. Nobody wants to talk about the war anyway. I don't, anyhow. When breakfast was over, Haywire told me to go out and take a breakfast. Said he'd finish up the dishes. He made me breakfast for me, and for Sam, too. Sam's breakfast, which was a heap of scrambled eggs made up with a tin of kippered herrings and a passel of chopped onions fried up with it and sprinkled all over with that red Louisiana hot sauce that Sam put aside in the pantry for himself. He brings his hot sauce along on every trip. Hash browns, too, that Haywire made, crisp as crackers. I sat across from Sam at the back table behind the frosted glass partition to the main seating. The conductor sat beside him drinking coffee. He got up before we had finished. The other Negro waiters was lounging across the aisle, snap-on bow ties hanging from the side of their collars they'd opened, showing a ring of neck grease, shucking and jiving with each other. And Sam finishes and shoves the empty plate up and sits back and feels for his pack of cigarettes, and Haywire comes up, shakes on out of his own pack one of his own Luckies for him, but he declines, preferring his own, which are Cools. Sam's lights up. I see the coal glow. He blinks at me, smoke in his eyes. Sam's got watery, bloodshot eyes, and he always looks sad. Saddest man in the world with those worried eyes. Though he's not a sad type, he just says very little and thinks a lot. His hands smell of pussy. I can smell them from across the table. He never washes his hands the first day after he visits his Seattle wife. He calls her that, but I don't think he really married her. He's got another wife and three kids back in St. Paul, and the fact is, his wife and my Maybelle was sisters. So Sam is like a brother to me, and I would not tell on him, even to my wife's sister. Sam looks up as he and exhaled a stream of smoke and said, "I feel real bad about Maybelle." I nodded. He did not know what else to say, but he had been at the funeral, and everything that could be said had been said by others. And I was glad there was so many. Say what you like about Negras. They know about funerals. They know about suffering and hardship. And they know what to do and how to take care of you. His wife had taken in our poor daughter for me, watching her for me while I was on the road until the polio had got my poor little girl, too. Haywire leaned at the wall in the passage to the diner and followed with his eyes as a couple of the waiters got up and gave me a $5 bill. I said, "What's this for?" and was a mind to refuse it if it was charity. But the one said, "For you, for the coffee. Don't know what you was, you done, but the folks out here just love that shit." Haywire squeezed in next to me, stretching his long legs out under the table, and leaned toward me and whispered out the side of his mouth in my direction, "Hershey bar." I nodded, but I admit it was a while before I figured out what he meant. But after I got it, I did that trick often, always a good thing, for breakfast especially, I don't know why. And I got to be sort of famous for my coffee. And I was careful not to let anyone else know how I'd done it. Haywire never told nobody, neither. And besides, this was going to be his last trip as a cook here anyway. But I did not know that then. I thanked him later after I figured it out. It was a good trip back. Not so hot as it'd been coming out. not so many seatings as we'd had since the tours was at an end now, anyway. It was, believe it or not, just the start of September, but already getting frigid cold in the Rockies. When we pulled up and stopped at East Glacier and got some of the last of the straggling tours back onto the train to take them back east and home to their tidy, tight-ass parlors and dull day-to-days and boring jobs. The wind was brisk and cold and biting, and there was a dust of icy snow blowing out of some grimy gray skies, and even the jackdaws had run off and was not there for our garbage like they usually was. I shot the shit with the commissary clerk at the door in my apron and cap, and he told me the same stories he'd used to tell everybody had told me more than once. About the old days when they used to put fresh killed chickens on board here, and I'd have to had to pluck 'em myself and finish off their butchery before dinner time. Or how they'd kept oysters still in their shells on ice, shipped from Elliott Bay out of Seattle there, waiting for our chef so that he could make them heaping oysters Rockefellers on half shell. The savory breadcrumb crown of them browned under the broilers just before they were served to those real swells who traveled back in those days, not like the kind today, no sir. Yes, but in those days served it up alongside with whole fillets of fresh-caught salmon, 4-foot-long head-to-tail on cedar planks they'd baked them on. And the pantryman would carve them up on a silver cart wheeled up in front of customers in the dining car, and a dollop of real yellow lemon hollandaise sauce on that plump pink fish flesh. Ah, those were the good days. My, oh my, and green pole beans, fresh too, with melted butter, yes, and peas, fresh out of pods, and fat hogs butchered on site daily, brought up just for the Empire Builder, right here in the commissary ice house. He done portioned the hogs hisself, and prime rib of beef, man. Man, oh man, a prime rib in those days was big as a horse's arse. Yes, sir, he said, shoving his fists in his front pockets. It did feel cold. He said he was getting hungry just thinking about it. I had to admit to him those were better days for sure. Haywire, who'd been leaning at the door above and behind me for some time while I stood in the smelly wisps of the steam that the train vented, had got a glittery look in his eyes and a smile stretched his thin lips. Sucking smoke out of his Lucky Strike cigarettes in the corner of his mouth. And he shook his head and sighed some sympathy at the old clerk who had turned away in his forlorn nostalgia, was walking off slow, head ducked against the cold wind. The conductor heaved the stepping stool back onto the platform of the door, signaling the engineer to start, and I clambed back up, Haywire tugging on my hand. He said, roast beef. Yeah, says I. Big as his wife's ass. No, a horse, he said. Same thing, said he, and slammed shut the lower half of the door, leaned out the top half, and took a last long drag on that cigarette as the train picked up speed and the station platform rolled away. Haywire drew back, noise rising, explained the clerk no longer had a job here anyway, blowing his cigarette smoke out in a long blue stream, had got fired a long time ago, and his wife was dead, in fact. He seen my look and said, oh, sorry. Then he went on to say he knew the stories about the swells and the oyster Rockefellers, and it was all true. He had been there. But I also know, said he, flicking his cigarette out the open window as we got up enough speed that the wind was blowing back ember and ash into his face, that the conductors used to whip a rope out the window with a rusty rail spike tied on the end of it, so it would bounce on the ties beneath the train and slap up and hit anyone under there riding on the rods for free. And I know that maybe 3 or 4 tramps were killed by conductors that way every week. And their bodies rolled over and chewed up by the dining car with the swells sitting at their silver service, eating their oyster Rockefellers. The conductor swung shut the window, latched it. And if he'd heard haywire, he didn't give a shit. "It is a happy and a cruel world, brother," he said. "A place to eat and a place to die. And if I'd rather, I'd rather eat. Let's make some roast beef, what you say?" And we did.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away, beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars all are empty, and the sun shines every day. On the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden..."